Hello and welcome to Our Food with me, Mary Brophy. Coming up on today's programme, I'll be finding out what it takes to grow the expensive delicacy that is Specialis status oysters in Donegal Bay.
50% of it is where you are, and all the oysters that leave Donegal Bay are special.
We'll discover how to make a decadent drink straight from the hedges.
You got to get the flowers, go back and immediately make it, because flowers actually go off.
And I pay a visit to Donegal's Pompeii, Rutland Island, to discover the strange remains of an industrial fishing station from the 1780s.
He didn't realise it, but he sat down on what he thought was a rock. Turned out to be a chimney.
The sound of a Ford 4000. How authentic is that?
I'm in the cab of a tractor with farmer Conor Reid as we make our way across to his fields to inspect the crops. Conor is no ordinary farmer. His fields sit in the pristine waters of Donegal Bay because Conor is farming oysters, about 600 tonnes per year.
This oyster farm's out in the middle of Donegal Bay, which is straight ahead of us here, as you can see. And immediately away beyond there is the open Atlantic, and behind us are the Blue Stack Mountains. And we're kind of in the area where all the water from the river and the River Esk and the open ocean meets, and our oyster farm's in the middle of it. The farm is situated what's called mean low water springs, so whenever there's a big spring tide, that's where you place an oyster farm. So in actual fact, it's covered for 80% of the time. In any given month, the farm is covered because it has to be covered. Alright, you're on your limit of your wellies, Emily.
Yeah, I know.
Now, lovely office, isn't it?
It's absolutely gorgeous.
You're in the middle of the oyster farm now, so you can see the trestles and bags. We started here in 1987 or 88. We're lucky in Donegal Bay that we produce top quality oysters. And I mean on a world class quality, really, because it's what's called a special quality, which is the highest quality mark in the oyster markets around the world. So I can show you.
Yeah, tell me what's involved in making an oyster, growing an oyster.
This size here, Mary, this was seed this year, so it takes 3 years. So we buy seed at this size here, maybe the size of your small fingernail, and that starts the cycle. And away they go. It takes 3 years minimum. It's a natural process. You can't do anything here. You can't manipulate the feeding. It's the tide comes in here, and whatever plankton grows naturally in the sea in the summer months is the productivity for our farm. When the oyster seed comes in first, it comes in January, February, March. So when the sea's starting to warm up, when sea temperature goes over 10 degrees centigrade, growth begins in the sea for the year and the process starts.
And what is the process? How do they grow?
They just start to feed on the plankton that occurs in the estuaries naturally every year. The sunlight shining on the sea here and the water exchange from the land. And in Donegal Bay in particular, it's hugely rich. There's an awful lot of nutrients coming in from the Esk River, and it's fairly good land around here, which is a benefit because it carries the nitrates into the estuary. It runs over limestone rock, which is also contributes greatly to the quality of the water arriving. And then the Atlantic, the tide comes in twice a day, every day, and it's pristine here. There's no stop between us and America, really. So there's no pollution, there's nothing like that. Which, say, other countries that are doing oyster farming or mussel farming would suffer greatly from.
This is a working landscape. Mesh bags of oysters clipped onto steel trestles form perfect rows in the waves of this stunning bay.
Double in size every 4 to 6 weeks.
Really? That quick?
Yeah, that quickly. When the growth is very strong, May, June and July, there's two sort of blooms in the ocean. There's a really early spring bloom, which is very strong. And then there's a lull in July and August, in particular this year when the sea temperature gets too warm. But really we're finding if you concentrate on really high quality and you get a lovely big succulent meat in them, which this bay, we're lucky enough that this bay gives us, well then you can really sell them year round with a peak in the market in that period from September to Christmas. Well, a special is basically the top maybe 8 or 10% of all the oysters produced in Europe. The total European oyster production is at about 150,000 tonnes. The French are probably about 130,000 of that. Of that 130 tonnes in the market, only about 10 to 13,000 tonnes is what's called special. That oyster goes directly to restaurants and retail trade. It doesn't go near the supermarket trade. As a general rule of thumb, 50% of it is where you are, and we're lucky to be in one of the best bays for it. You can do nothing about that. You're either in a good bay or you're not. And then the other 50% is how hard you're prepared to work at it. And all the oysters that leave Donegal Bay are special. The perfect oyster is the shape of a teardrop, as you can see. And you shake the bag. That's where the physical side of the business comes in, and the intensity. Very important that you do that, because what you do is you force the oyster to have a deep cup. So the deeper the oyster is, the more meat,
the more flesh
is on it. And so that's really what people like to eat. An oyster will actually grow like a banana if you just leave it alone. If you don't work it or grate it and that, it'll just grow in whatever direction.
And how do you manipulate that?
You have to take all these bags in the summer when they're growing and take them off like this. Actually, I'll show you. You'll be able to hear it. You take all the bags off, unclip them, and we shake them and we turn them over. And you go around the whole farm 4 times. You can see we've changed the position of those oysters now in the bag, and that keeps the growth rate much more uniform, the shape. The oyster's much healthier. He's getting moved around.
There's the protected geographical...
Yeah, the PGIs.
So what is the protected geographical
indicator? Well, that's where if you're producing a food that's unique, for example, Camembert, Bordeaux wine, well, then you can apply for a PGI and you're given this unique status. So it's...
A hugely valuable marketing, yeah, really, wouldn't
it? It'll reflect Donegal Bay, really, because it's quite unique for doing this, you know, as we discovered after time that, you know.
Where is your customer?
Some go into London directly, a small bit goes to Germany, and some go to Holland. 80% of them go to France. A lot of the French companies that we deal with are starting to re-export them then to Hong Kong and China and markets like this, emerging markets like this. That's the consumption on that side of the world is huge in oysters. Donegal Bay would be probably in the top 3 bays in Europe in terms of volume of and ability to produce special oysters. We're a very good sized farm in terms of special production. Our objective then is how do we best realise the potential of that? I mean, we're selling these oysters to France to be consumed, which are rebranded as French oysters and sold all over the world as French oysters, when in actual fact are Donegal Bay special oysters. So that's the next thing for us. That's why we're looking for the new licences. We're very lucky in that we've got a good big licence here. But if we were to take on boxing our own oysters and branding them, well, then we need another 300 or 400 ton to have a critical mass to in order to sustain that. And we have, despite the size of our farm, we're still short on that. So that's why we're really looking for more licenses to be able to produce more oysters, to be able to go to the next stage of the business, which is to brand them. I suppose it's reasonable to assume that you would get the license fairly quickly, given the track record, but that seems to be taking forever. I suppose it gets very frustrating too when you're in the middle of a recession in a county with the highest unemployment rate, in a business that is export driven. So all the oysters that we sell, I mean, that money comes directly back into this rural economy of Donegal Town, which is crucial because there's nothing else on the horizon for Donegal, unfortunately. So when you're lucky enough to have a natural resource such as this, as in our bays and estuaries, and to prove that this type of farming is a perfect fit within the SACs that are here, well, then we should be absolutely prioritising it. When you consider the pressure that traditional fishery is under, and all the exits in terms of inshore fishing and the jobs and all that over the last decade, where either quota or just the fish weren't there anymore, well, this is what we should be doing.
A successful food business there with significant plans for expansion. Now, what better way to accompany oysters than with a crisp glass of champagne? All the better if it was free. Well, each year, about late May or early June, our roadsides and hedges are filled with a unique perfume as the lacy cream flowers of the elder come into bloom. These are the star ingredients for elderflower champagne, a light alcoholic drink that's a bit like lemonade but has the most amazing smell as you sip. Martina Gardner shared her tried and trusted recipe with me, and we first went to a closely guarded secret location where she gathers the best flower heads. So we're here today, Martina, on a very windy day, and we're coming down through the field, and you know of a good stand of elder trees along here.
Yeah, you want ones that are maybe away from main roads, because I would be concerned about maybe lead from the cars and things. So this is just a very scenic little part of the island, and they have there's just a gigantic row of elderflower trees. Some of them are really easy to pick because they're not too high.
Yeah.
So that's why I come back here every year. You need to have everything ready at home before you go out. You don't want to be thinking of going to the supermarket to buy lemons after you've picked the flowers. You've got to get the flowers really quickly. Go back and immediately make it, because flowers actually go off, and certainly overnight they lose their smell. You want to just capture that as much freshness as you can, and so you've got to do things really quickly.
So we've come right over to the corner of the field here. Yeah. We're on a bit of a slope, and I see what you mean. All these elder trees are quite low. It's almost like a bush really, rather than the trees, aren't they?
Well, really it's bushes we're after. The trees are literally too high.
Yeah.
We'll never get at them. So as you can see, the flower heads are different sizes. Yeah. So I need, for my bucket, 20 to 25 flower heads. But every tree is a little bit different. Some have really big flower heads. Some will obviously have a mixture. So here's what I would call basically an average size. This would be about 10 centimetres in diameter.
Apart from the size then, what are you looking for in the ripeness, or when is it perfect for making champagne?
Okay, the whole flower will be open. It'll have a gorgeous scent. Just smell really strongly of elderflower, obviously. That's really it. Just a pure ripe flower, not one that's going over, not one that's underripe.
Yeah. And when it's going over, how do you know that?
Well, it starts to discolour. They go brown. The little flowers are brown on the outside. It needs to be dry. Told that being sunny is better. Now, I don't know. It's not always sunny when I pick them, but it's definitely always dry.
Yeah.
I'd have my six lemons. I would have their unwaxed lemons because we're going to use the rind. I would have my white wine vinegar, which is just 4 big tablespoons. We're going to need of that. And I have some sugar, a packet of sugar, you know, like a 1 kg packet.
Right.
So all of that's going to be going into a big 10-litre bucket. Now, that's a bucket you'll get anywhere, you know, just an average bucket.
Yeah.
And everything I'm going to use is going to be sterilised. I know it's not winemaking, but some of the principles apply. And you don't have to be quite as particular as winemaking, but everything's sterilised. All of the implements that I'm going to use are sterilised. Mm. So that way you can be sure that there's no contaminants.
Yeah.
You can be pretty much more certain of a good outcome.
Mm.
So I'll take these 20, 25 flower heads home. And then I want to start mixing up a sugary solution in my bucket. I'll put in the packet of sugar, put in a little bit of boiling water, just enough to dissolve the sugar. So I fill it up to almost the top with cold water, because I don't want the liquid to be too hot when I'm putting in the flowers. I don't do anything particularly with them. I just take off the worst of the leaves, or you know, any leaves that have come off the tree that shouldn't be there. Any too many stalks, maybe cut them up a bit. I also add the juice and rind of 6 lemons. And the only other thing that we have to add to that bucket is white wine vinegar. 4 tablespoons of it will start the fermentation process. I would cover it with a nice clean tea towel. I think I'm told I should stir it 3 or 4 times a day. It might only be twice a day, but you must stir it, and you must keep it in that bucket for 2 days. After those 2 days in the bucket, I would bottle it.
As the natural yeast produces CO2 gas from the sugars, pressure builds in the bottles, and so Martina prefers to use 500ml plastic bottles for her elderflower bubbly to avoid any champagne outbursts.
And again, this is why we like to use the plastic bottles. If you had glass, you might be at this point worried. If you had too much yeast on the flowers for whatever reason, you could end up with quite an explosive mixture in the glass bottle, which I don't think would be too good. So you don't have too long to wait. If you're doing this at the beginning of the elderflower season, you have time to enjoy it, taste it, feel enthusiastic, and go back out and do some more. And if you have some success, it's really exciting. It's, you know, like you're creating something amazingly busy and refreshing out of things that are just there for free. When you've seen an elderflower tree once, you don't forget where it is. If you start making elderflower champagne, you have earmarked all the best trees. So, and you hope to get there before your rivals. Yeah. This is a true story.
Do you have rivals?
I definitely do. I didn't know who the rival was for at least a year, but I then ended up in that person's house drinking their champagne and being very impressed. I realised that he was picking in the same spot as me. You could see trails of people where they've been, you see. Especially if you've eyed up your flowers and then you get back 2 days later and they're gone. I mean, it's very disappointing. It's a bit of build up sometimes. It's a bit like jam making or something. You're building up, you've got everything in place, and then that day seems to suit you. So you kind of want your flowers when you want them.
So you have a few that you've made earlier.
Yeah.
So we'll go and check them out.
Okay.
So here we are, Martina, with the finished product. It has that lovely straw yellow, that pale colour. So do you want to open it up there and we'll hear the fizz?
Go.
Wow, and we can see the bubbles all rising to the top. That looks the part, all right.
Okay. So pour it out.
We have two champagne glasses here. This feels very decadent in the afternoon, doesn't it? Oh, it's gorgeous.
And so here it is, like literally coming out over the top of the glass, which is just as you imagine a good bottle of champagne should be.
Oh, that's lovely. It's so light, and you know, just as you put the glass to your nose, you can smell the perfume. You can almost smell the elderflower. You really can.
I think that's the beauty also. You can carry these bottles through successfully for a few months. I have not tried to store them really for long term, but you know, you'll get these right up to Christmas, and you know, it just really reminds you of summer.
Next, I'm taking a boat trip with historian Patrick Bonner. We're heading out to Rutland Island from Burtonport to explore the curious remains of an industrial fishing station set up here in the 1700s. In 1783, William Burton Cunningham, a so-called improving landlord, set in motion his grand scheme to build a fishing industry and community on this tiny island to take advantage of the vast herring shoals off the coast.
Good a point as any over here. What you can see here is buildings without roofs, and you can see gables of buildings which are covered by sand. What happened here in between 1810 and 1822 was that there were huge storms and the sandbanks off Rutland broke and came right over the island and just swamped whatever was left of the structures of the northeast side of the island. So there's actually a street up there, believe it or not, and there are gables of buildings that you can see as you go through on the ferry to Arran Moor. You can actually see the custom house, you can see warehouses, or at least what's left of them, and one observer in the 19th century called it an Irish Pompeii, that he didn't realise it, but he sat down on what he thought was a rock, turned out to be a chimney. There's a beautiful beach on the other side, and that building there, you see the long building, was a store called the Union Store. It was named after the Act of Union, 1801, so it's built about that time. The main complex here was developed in about 1786 by William Burton Cunningham, who was the landlord at the time. And when people talk about Rutland, they think it's just this island, but in fact the Rutland fishing development encompassed Evernish, which is opposite here, Inishcoo, Inish Macadern, which was renamed Rutland, and some of the smaller islands as well. So
this was Inish Macadern?
Yes. It was occupied by local people at the time, and in fact they had to be forcibly moved. But Cunningham himself put a huge amount of money in here. He put something like 20,000 of his own money, and he persuaded the Irish Parliament, who were all friends of his of course, to put matching funds of 20,000. And if you take that in today's money, 20 plus 20, 40,000, you're talking tens of millions, and it was a massive development. There's a streets were laid out on the 1788 map. It looked like quite a large town, but of course it's all whatever's there now is under sand. There are other houses and warehouses which are partly standing. The roofs have gone. Some of them are almost entirely covered by sand. But this street is well, you'll see when we get to the main area, but it actually looks exactly like it did in 1786.
Wow. When I heard about this place, there's essentially a street of terraced houses on an island. I didn't really quite believe it, and it's just hard to believe when you're looking at it here. It's essentially like a coronation street almost.
It is. It's a very, it was something like a folly, something that people built recently. But this, what we're looking at now, is 220 years old. But it was a big investment. Fish had come onto this coast in huge numbers in the 1770s, herring. And they, boats were coming from Scotland and from all around the coast to try and exploit that. So Cunningham, William Burton Cunningham, decided that he'd actually build an in situ factory and processing place. And that's what he did here. And he built this street we're on. I mean, it's hard to imagine now. If you look around, the people who were living here, you know, were working in salt works, curing works, processing fish in all kinds of ways. There was a boat building yard on Inish Coo, the island that we were looking at earlier. It was a hive of activity. There were hundreds of people living and working here.
And there's 8 houses on both sides, so a terrace of 16 in total.
On the drawings, which are still available in the National Archive, it's called Tarrant Street. It gets called Duck Street round here, which is a facetious corruption of Duke Street after the Duke of Rutland. Rutland was named for the then Lord Lieutenant of Ireland. He was a good friend of William Burton Cunningham's. And what Cunningham did when he laid out the town, he named all the streets after his friends. So there's a Corbett Street, there was a Tarrant Street here. And he went around all the people who had helped him get the money through Parliament, and he named the places after them. Okay, now we're now inside the house in the centre of the street. And as you can see, the way the thing was constructed, it's made out of granite with brick surrounds on the doors. And they're very substantially made. No roof on this one, unfortunately.
Do you know where the idea for the terraced housing? There was no housing like this around here.
Well, Cunningham was involved in the Dublin Streets project, you know, that Gandon laid out Dublin. So he had experience of it. So his idea was he wanted to create something as was being created in Dublin, which were very fine streets, and they're still standing today. But in its time, this was the best. Cunningham was determined to make the location as attractive as possible to bring people here. But he figured that he'd be capturing all of the fishing trade of the northwest coast. The first few years, the catches weren't as big as they were in the 1770s, but they were still very substantial. And he thought it'd be a blip and that it would start going back up again. But the herring's an unpredictable fish, and they completely disappeared in 1793. So the whole thing collapsed.
So there was only about 3 or 4 years of prosperity.
Yes. Yeah. Very unfortunate. If it was a mine, at least you'd do some surveying and you'd have some sense that you've got 20, 30 years of mining to do. With the sea and the herring, it's just so unpredictable. And I guess he didn't have the science and the history to know that you could actually put 40,000 or tens of millions into an investment and then 10 years later you have nothing to show for it, which is what happened. If you think about it, he was investing money in here from 1785-86. And within 6 or 7 years, the whole thing collapsed. No fish. To add insult to injury, the sandbanks broke and blew sand right over the top of all of the warehouses and the the street on the northern side of the island.
Well, that's it for today. We'll be back here next week with more food stories from around the county.
Our Food is a Hollybrook production for Highland Radio, funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with a television licence fee.